large, so you can just solve the problem in one dimension. And but of course, the point is that when you're looking at 10 to the power 6 Tesla or more, then these are of course absurdly large compared to what you have in the lab. So yeah, so does it even, okay, fine, it can be somebody's fancy. Of course, one can always say that, okay, there are objects in the universe, you can always find something. So one can always say there are objects in the universe which will, you know, there are neutron stars and some kind of special neutron stars which people don't know much about called magnetars, where such magnetic fields can exist. But anyway, so as I said, so let me just, but basic idea could still work with systems which have a few orders of magnitude, say a couple of orders of magnitude larger confinement length scale. So of course we're talking only about zero angular momentum states, because otherwise you have to worry about Zeeman splitting. And in that case, there is a possibility of getting the magnetic length to be of the order of the length scale of confinement, some other confinement, which could be due to confinement, physical confinement in a quantum dot, or confinement within a bound state. So excitons in semiconductors is one of the things which I've been quite interested in for some time, which sort of turn out to be almost ideal, okay, or at least in zeroth approximation turn out to be like hydrogen atoms. A lot of mathematics goes through for hydrogen atoms. Anyway, so the point is that, so if you have something like 6 to 10, whatever, so you get these kind of length scales, so around 10 nanometer for 13 Tesla. So this is also an interesting example from technology, the fact that magnetic field reduces the dimension by 2. And this is an old experiment from, I think, 1982, I'm not completely sure about the year, where basically they just have these quantum well lasers and they applied a high magnetic field. And then they saw that there's a dramatic improvement in the laser characteristics. And so essentially what was happening was that, yeah, as I said, that if you have a two-dimensional system to begin with and you apply a perpendicular magnetic field, then you're reducing dimensions by 2, so you end up with quantum dots. And this is one of the works which sort of, this was long before the growth of quantum dots. It was almost 10 years before quantum dots became popular. This is sort of an influential paper in that context. Okay, so very quickly again, so this is just one thing which I have sort of been attracted to because of its simplicity. But there are of course lots of reasons to look at magnetic fields. And essentially over the past 10 years or so, maybe around 20, but they've always been important. And there's a resurgence in interest over the past, say, a decade or so, especially in the field of strongly correlated systems. And essentially in many of these systems, you have a fine balance between a lot of interactions, and you have another tunable parameter, which is a thermodynamic variable in a quantum sense, and which can sort of tune the balance a bit. And therefore, you can get to various kinds of phase transitions. This is one example of some data I've taken quite some time back, where you can see that you can, in a manganite, you can affect a phase transition by applying a magnetic field. So this is some data. This is actually not a very large field, but it's done in pulse fields. And yeah, so there are many, many examples. You can take your pick. So meaning there's this whole field, which is again becoming popular past 10 years, as single crystals of superconductors have become popular, again, of doing Fermi surface mapping through quantum oscillations. And yeah, so there are the whole range of things which one can do. Okay, and just to be complete, so again, so what I'm trying to motivate is as to what large fields mean. And in this context, when you have a quantum system, meaning, so when you apply a magnetic field, then density of states for a three-dimensional system, which was an e to the power half, develops, still stays one-dimensional along the direction of the magnetic field, and it develops singularities at the Landau levels. And of course, for these to be well-resolved, you want, so these Landau orbits are getting quantized, so you want the electron to not scatter before it's completed many circles, many cyclotron orbits. So that is characterized by this dimensionless ratio, that the cyclotron frequency should be much larger than the collision frequency. And secondly, since your level structure is getting, say, in two dimensions, at least the two dimensional density of states is becoming discrete, and the structure should be well resolved enough compared to the temperature. So these are the two things which you need for high magnetic field. This is standard. And so the cyclotron energy, if I just put it in, so these are constants, I can think of cyclotron energy for, say, free electrons, turns out to be something like a Kelvin per Tesla. So for many lab experiments of these kind, 10 Tesla would be characterized as a large field. And often, because of this reason, you would want the B by T ratio to be large. Okay, so that's normally often, especially for people who can go to also very low temperatures, people would like to talk about B by T ratio, that you want low temperatures and high fields in combination. Anyway, so operationally one would say something like 10 Tesla would be large to observe a range of phenomena. So after this very sort of quick and dirty introduction, is there any questions or comments? Yeah, maybe we can. So we can, so I'll just, now the main part where I'll just discuss the generation of fields. And we said that something like 10 Tesla is large, and it actually is quite large, primarily because the mu naught, the free space permeability, is so small. And so we normally get away, because you put in a ferromagnetic core, which sort of enhances, which has a large susceptibility, so it would enhance the field considerably until you align all the spins and it doesn't help anymore. So, but otherwise, if I just put in some very brute force order of magnitude numbers, so then the field is just mu naught number of turns per unit length. This is for an infinite solenoid. I can just try to pull out a number. And the heating is, of course, I squared R. So to generate 1 Tesla, I would need something like 1,000 amps. Give and take a factor of 2, an order of magnitude. And if I put in some number for resistance, then you see the power turns out to be of the order of a megawatt, or say 100 kilowatts, that order. So even generating 1 Tesla is non-trivial. And of course, we all know that the way about it is to either work with iron core magnets or with some kind of ferromagnetic cores, or you, of course, minimize the resistance, and so up to around 18 Tesla you can have laboratory superconducting magnets. But above 18 Tesla they get really expensive, because when the stored energies become very, very large, because it's still the inductive energy which is stored, and suddenly if there's a problem, this have to be, of course, as everybody knows, need to be in helium, often in supercooled state, superfluid state, they can be dangerous if it suddenly quenches. And 22 Tesla is sort of the maximum field which is available. So, and above 20 Tesla, one goes back to these resistive magnets, which, as we saw, would consume enormous amounts of power. And so typical magnet would be something like 20 megawatts. I was in one such lab. I hated it there, because it's just, you know, it's like too big. And these large infrastructures, this is like one per continent or something. And you can get 35 Tesla every year, or every 2 years, they keep increasing by a couple of Tesla by optimizing. So it's a very, very fine art of optimizing. So I should not spend too much time on this. But the idea is that you have these, instead of using a normal solenoid, the way you do it is that you have these disks which have a 1 upon R current distribution, and then you have these holes which have water flowing through them at some rate. So this is one of the obscene ends, which is this 45 Tesla hybrid magnet, which has, say, 15,000 liters of water every minute flowing through it. Okay. So you essentially generate this huge amount of power, and it's always a problem, because you're always scared that suddenly if it generates a hot spot, and there are, of course, enormous stresses that you discuss, then it can just suddenly, in this case also, just burn out, and then you have a million dollars gone. So it's of course an art, And one should say that a lot of very nice science has come out of this, and meaning the quantum Hall effect was discovered in some such facility, and a lot of other very, very interesting phenomena have come out of these facilities. But these are things which, yeah, okay, these are what they are. The other thing which is what one can do sitting at home is to instead minimize the time. And that's where the pulse magnets come in, and the idea being that you pass, so since heating is current squared times resistance times time, so you just pass a very large current for a few milliseconds, okay. And so it's like it's a capacitive discharge circuit, which is like a camera flash. So you just have the field for a short time and finish your experiment during that. And that's what we are talking about. And this is a typical pulse magnet, which so you have a bank of capacitors which you charge to some voltage, and then you have a switch which you close. So it's just an LCR circuit. R comes from the inevitable resistance which you will have in the solenoid, and when you close it, you just generate a field. This is a characteristic field shape which most pulse magnets have. So you make sure that it doesn't oscillate. So there's a way to crowbar it, but that's an important, that's just a detail. But the idea is you get a field like this. And depending on the kind of a magnet you have, how big a facility it is, what bank you have essentially. So this rise time can be, typically it's about 5 milliseconds, and it can go up to 100 milliseconds for smaller fields. And the largest field which people can reliably generate in large magnets now in these facilities is something of the order of 70 Tesla. And of course, this whole measurement is complete within a few milliseconds, which is mostly okay, because if you're looking at solid state systems, then it's the relaxation times of the order of nanoseconds or picoseconds usually, the momentum relaxation times of the order of few picoseconds. So it's mostly okay. So I will talk about this. So that of course depends on how big you want to make it. So yeah, it can be from a few kilojoules up to megajoules. So, okay, so let's just do a back of the envelope estimate. So I want to, for instance, I want to have a certain amount of energy, and let me see how much field I can generate. Or say I want to generate something which has 35, 40 Tesla. How much energy do I want to put in? So I'll just do a very simple back of the envelope estimate. So I just dump the half CV squared into half LI squared, which is the inductive energy. And that inductive energy is, by definition, the magnetic energy stored in the coil. So of course, when I have to calculate the inductance, I have to do the integral over all space for this. So but I again fudge and put the coil volume to get an order of magnitude estimate. So then I see that the magnetic field, as expected, depends on how much I charge my capacitor bank to. Goes as square root of capacitance, inversely as square root of volume, and square root of energy. And interestingly, the number of turns which I had in the coil doesn't make a difference. So I can make any coil pretty much in this zeroth order estimate. I just dump this energy and I get the same field. What the number of turns of course do is that if you have large number of turns, then you will have more resistance and you have a longer pulse, shorter. So you basically, this inductor is not a free parameter, it drops out. And meaning in some sense the inductance comes in with the current. So if you reduce the inductance, the current goes up and so on. So I just put in these numbers, and then I can see that for a 500 millifarad bank and 500 volts, which amounts to something like 75 kilojoules of energy, I can generate 40 Tesla. So I put a fudge factor here, because actually I'm back calculating. You have to do a better calculation, of course, which is to take care of some losses. So typically at 1 upon E would be the current at critically damped. So this is what you would expect. So we'll come to this. So again, this is, as I said, a very personalized account of, if any of the students, anybody wants to sort of do a facility, so then it just sort of, let's just in the next 10 minutes, 15 minutes, try to make a facility ourselves. Facility is too big a word. Let's try to, set up a pulse field system ourselves. So what you need is of course a generator circuit, which I'll just talk in some detail. So I've just focused more on just the instrumentation part. And then we'll talk about some transport measurements and what kind of measurements, the optical spectroscopy which you can do. So the ingredients for such a setup would be that you need a generator circuit, you need a magnet coil, so how to design a magnet coil, what are the constraints for that. Then you have to talk about cryostats, and then you need some fast measurement electronics, you have to, because the whole measurement is just over in a few milliseconds. And then you have to worry about safety, and then there are certain specialized measurement techniques which I'll see if I have time for. So the generator circuit is actually pretty straightforward, meaning if you want to keep it straightforward. And what we have done is just 500 volts. You can buy these capacitors from this Nasik based company, and you just essentially make up this LCR circuit together. And you can just make a small capacitor bank and the electronics, and this is what it looks like. So this is a setup which I've been having trouble having PhD students stay back for this project. Most people just come and leave after 6 months, I don't know. So most of the work has been done by undergraduates, a couple of MS thesis projects. Anyway, so this is the, and you can just set it up quite cheaply. So this is 500 volts. So that's one of the reasons that since we are working in a very small space in an undergraduate institute, so this is actually a little unusual, and it's generally believed that you need to get to much higher voltages, but actually it doesn't matter. So I think basically with this is 500 volts is the maximum. So usually people go to, so big generators go to 16 kilovolts, sometimes even 24 kilovolts. 5 kilovolts is the minimum people work with. But they come with a lot of problems because all the electronics, you have to constantly worry about the low noise part and then things shorting. And generally it just gets much more difficult if you go above 400, 500 volts. So it turns out that it doesn't really matter. You can work with small voltages if you play around with the current density in the coil in the correct way. Okay, so second is a magnet coil. And so the point is that you have this generator, and then how would you design a coil? And so for instance, what kind of an aspect ratio would you choose? So for DC magnets, this is sort of well known. I spent around a few months, maybe a year, trying to design pulsed coils. So I forgot most of it, but some of these things I'll kind of like talk about. So for DC magnets, it's sort of well known that you get a maximum efficiency from the coil in terms of power when you have an aspect ratio of where the alpha is the inner radius by outer radius, which is a factor of 3, and beta is the height by the inner ratio, half the height by the, or the inner diameter, the height by the inner diameter, which is of the order of 2. But for pulse magnets, we saw that the number of turns don't really make a difference, and in fact, the optimization is not very clear what it would be, and you are working with a fixed energy and not with fixed power. And secondly, heating is adiabatic, that you just, the whole thing just heats up in a few milliseconds, so it's so it doesn't have much time to interact with the surroundings. So when you're optimizing a pulse magnet coil, then you have to worry about impedance matching the coil with the bank. So whatever that means, what means is that you want to generate a highest possible field with a reasonable pulse length, unless you are choosing to do a different kind of measurement. So most of these coils, unless you want to do something specialized, which you can easily, like you can make a split coil or something, but since you want to maximize the fields, you just go with the solenoid geometry, which is the simplest after toroid, meaning which is the most efficient after toroid. Toroid is of course not much useful. Then it should not get too heated. So one trick which one uses is that you just dump the whole system in 77K, because nickel nitrogen is cheap, and strength of copper increases a little, or strength of any conductor increases a little bit. And moreover, the resistance, for instance, if you're working with pure copper or reasonably okay copper, would drop by a factor of 5 to 7. So you really gain on that. And then you get a good temperature window of around 200 Kelvin or maybe 250 Kelvin, which you can let the coil heat up to. And so of course, so since you're dumping a particular amount of energy which has to go through the coil, so that immediately determines what kind of a mass you minimum need, because the heat capacity of the coil should be able to take that much energy without heating up too much. So which means immediately that if you have a big facility, so if you have a 100 kilojoule bank, like the one we have, then 1 kg of copper is enough, the small coil is enough. But if you're working with 16 megajoules or something, then you have a coil which is bigger than me. And that comes with a lot of complications because it can heat up, of course, during the pulse, but cooling can take 6 hours or more sometimes. And of course, the most important and the critical part is that the coil should not explode. And it's not very obvious, but actually Lorentz forces become the determining factor, because other things can be covered by cost, but Lorentz force is something which you can't really fight, because we'll discuss this. So it's the Lorentz forces which sort of determine the maximum field which you can achieve. And this is a non-trivial, people have sort of figured out. You have to typically do a finite element analysis of the detailed design, but even then it's not very trivial, because various components of stress get coupled and you have plastic deformation. And of course, when you're working with newer materials, which one is always trying to do to get to more strength, then the properties themselves may not be well known.
So what is the peak current that you get?
So typically, so we get something like 30 kiloamps. Yes.
30 kiloamps.
Yeah, because mu naught is fixed, so you need to give that much current. So something like, something like more like 25 kiloamps. So this is, so I'll just mention a couple of things about stress. So if you were again to do a order of magnitude estimate for the stress, then to a zeroth approximation, one can think of just the stress energy tensor, the diagonal part, which is just half mu naught b squared. So if I just write the stress and I put in a geometry factor, which is again some kind of a fudge factor, which basically is the ratio of how thick my walls of the cylinder are to the size of my cylinder. So then I can just get these numbers and I can compare with the ultimate tensile strength for different materials. It turns out for copper, actually the peak field, so above 22 Tesla, you will not be able to make a copper coil with soft copper, and so on. So you need to get to something like, to get to 70 Tesla, if you just, depending on the material properties, then you would need some very strong alloy which is specially prepared, but even then it's probably not enough or just about enough. And the geometry helps a bit, so it actually, and that's again a reason why if you want to get to much higher fields, then you need much larger coils, because it helps to distribute the stress. So typically the larger the coil, it would be actually much bigger. Okay, so one of the unfortunate things is that so if you could just plot strength versus conductivity, so roughly as one would expect, the conductivity drops drastically as the strength increases, because you're working with alloys and things like that, and that's of course very, very bad for an LCR circuit in all aspects. And of course one should remember that both these heating and stress go as b squared. So of course people have tried various kinds of materials, then during the 90s there was this idea that instead of just depending on the materials, what I do is that I make a composite and try to optimize the stress within the coils. I've not really gone into the details. So you make a stress optimized coil in such a way that instead of having a constant current through the coil, you try to make stress in each winding to be more or less constant. And the way you do it is that so you choose some material. It doesn't matter. So let's just choose the material. So usually one would choose the material with the highest conductivity, and then you have a layer of that material, and then you put an appropriate amount of non-conducting material which has high strength, some kind of a fiber. So xylon is some trademark material. You can have carbon fiber or fiberglass or whatever. So xylon is something which is typically used because it has the highest known strength. So essentially you make it layer by layer, and the calculation, you make sure that stress through the layers is the same, and the idea being that, so you have a conductor and you just wind a layer of this fiber around it, then another layer of conductor, another layer of fiber, and you can calculate thickness such that most of the stress is contained by the fiber. So the idea being, so this is a typical stress strain curve, say of copper or any material. So you have the linear regime and then it begins to flow. And as soon as it begins to flow, it's like containing a liquid. So the wire starts to flow and then it's contained by this high strength fiber. So it's basically the conductivity is coming from the wire and the strength is coming from the fiber. And so this is, so you can do a more detailed calculation. And so this is a calculation which we did for our bank for one of the coils. And yeah, so this is the windings and you can put this reinforcement and you can simulate what the field would be like. It's like a design. And this is what say the actual field looks like. And so this coil was actually, because so around 20 Tesla we can wind coils ourselves, but after that it's too much effort to do it because it's very specialized and there are people who are very good at it. And at Wuhan Institute of Science and Technology, Dr. Tao Peng, he's actually been very nice. He sort of, I sent him the design, he improved it slightly because he's been doing it for a long time. He so mailed it back to us. No, he just did it gratis. So I knew him a bit, so anyways. So. And so this again, so this is kind of a field which you can get. So the advantage is that you can always change the capacitor and I can change this. This is kind of the, so I can change the rate of field and I can change the kind of field which I get. And very quickly, let me just, so one of the simplest ways to measure the field is that we just put a test coil and which will pick up a time dependent induced voltage which you just integrate. And this is nice because it just, it's just depends on Maxwell's equations. So you're not worrying about any of the material properties. You just need to do a good integration. So of course, there's an unknown area factor which is there and which is critical. So right now what we have done is that because if somebody sends you a calibrated coil, then you can calibrate all your coils against that. This is not the best way. So in future, or that's, one would, of course, and then one does this at lower fields, that you calibrate it against some other measurement. But the best way is to do it directly. And so there are materials which have known phase transitions at very specific temperatures. So either you can use that, or one of the ways which we used to do it in Leuven is that you have some Zeeman splitting, I think of diamond levels or something, which is very precisely known. And then you can just look at these peaks, which are sharp emission peaks, and those you can calibrate with. Anyway, so very quickly, so yeah, so cryostats again, one can make, so what one needs to be important, what is important is that you should not have any conducting parts, so you use sapphire. And if you look at any standard book like Richardson and Smith, you can see that the thermal conductivity of sapphire is larger than copper, up to 10K. And it's an insulator, so sapphire is a very nice material, which you can again buy quite cheaply from, got some from Lithuania. And yeah, so that's the whole thing. And since we don't have helium, so we've sort of, there was an old closed cycle which was lying around. And since there's this distance, so the temperature is around 6K, that's what we can get to the top. So I think we need to improve this and also have some flow kind of a system where you can actually get to 4K or below. And 77Ks, of course, you can always make. And so this other thing is electronics. You need to make sure that you are simultaneously triggering, which is again not difficult at all these days. That so you send a trigger pulse, which starts the, which you send a trigger pulse to the thyristor, which closes the switch. And at the same time, you trigger your data logger. And then you can plot field versus the signal. And you know you made an okay measurement when the rising and the falling edge are on top of each other, because these are very different time scales, so it's a good measure. And okay.
Rising and falling edge of your sample?
Oh, you measure actually two values of field during the pulse.
So if the sample has hysteresis?
Then you will not see it, of course. So that's how I'll come to. So there are problems, of course. So I've said, been very glib. Actually, it's not that easy to do measurements, and we are actually struggling quite a bit. So one of the problems, of course, is that if you have eddy currents, so this is not something which is so much of a problem because you know what kind of measurements to do. So basically, nobody uses pulse fields below 4K seriously. Optics, you can still do, because often, again, you don't know what the temperature is in optics. You usually, so I think when you're doing condensed matter physics experiments, strongly correlated materials of some kind are the best to work with. And there's a lot of noise because you are actually, it's like hitting something with a hammer because you're passing 30,000 amps of current for a few milliseconds. So it's, so it's this, everything will shake and all wires will shake, shaking wires will pick up voltages, so it's always a problem. And then again, the sample itself will always have some area. And any measurement which you do will have a pickup signal like that, which would mimic the field pickup signal. And so what you typically need to do is to do two measurements, either with plus field and minus field and cancel it, or you do it with plus current and minus current and cancel it. And so basically, this is just to show that this is what you measure and the actual signal may be this small. Okay. And so this is, of course, a challenge unless you pass very, very high currents to the sample. So this, this is a resistance measurement, just to show. So, but the point is that many of these advantages actually, well, these disadvantages or problems can actually become interesting. So, for instance, when you have eddy currents, you can do contactless susceptibility measurements, or which you can do susceptibility is basically like the measuring resistivity. There's some measurement which I had done long back when you just, that you can actually see just for nickel, you can just do a sweep rate dependence and from this you can figure out what the conductivity is. So especially if you're looking at composites or polycrystals, that may be nice. I've been trying to look at it with some undergraduates, but yeah, we've not really made much progress. And the second thing which really is interesting is that you have a rate of change of field which is like 10,000 Tesla per second. And so of course, most condensed matter phenomena are expected to not, meaning we actually would have equilibrated within a nanosecond or less. There are certain situations where things can get slow, especially close to phase transitions, and that's something which has been my recent interest. And for instance, if you have metastable states close to first order phase transition, then you can get hysteresis, and hysteresis can be rate dependent, which is something which we're looking at. Then again, close to second order phase transitions also, you can have dynamical hysteresis because of critical slowing down, as Pratap was saying, that you can have hysteresis, which can again be rate dependent, and can have various kinds of things. So this is something which is nice, because if you have a facility at home, I mean, if you have a setup at home, then you can keep playing around, which is not possible to do in a large facility. So this is, I think, one of the biggest advantages. One is that you can do measurements up to certain fields very easily and repeatedly. The other is that you can play around and do novel kind of experiments when you have something at home. And for noise, this again, what you can do is, of course, there's a large pickup noise, which actually one can largely eliminate by using a lock-in amplifier. And since commercial lock-in amplifiers won't work, so because you have a field which is, your signal which is changing too fast, so you need to modulate at this significant Fourier weight, even up to 100 kilohertz. So you need to modulate at much higher frequencies for these kind of pulse lengths. So if you modulate at 1 megahertz, for instance, and then just record on two channels, this reference and the signal, and do what a commercial lock-in amplifier does, which is to multiply the reference with the signal and then do a low-pass filter. So this is something, again, which you can do. So this kind of works in principle and works in practice. But there's a problem, because when you're actually, it works, but we are still struggling in the sense that circuits typically tend to resonate sometimes even as low as 10, 20 kilohertz. And so you see that because there are always stray capacitances and stray inductances, especially if you have long wires, which you need. So there's something which we are struggling with. Yeah, you can still sort of extract the signal out, but we are not very happy with the fact that, you know, it's difficult to minimize the, when you always get some signal out of phase. And so, okay, so this is something which we'll be setting up. I've got all the equipment, but we've not still set up here. And so one of the other things which one can do is to do optics experiments. And the idea is that you send in light through a set of fibers, and then you can collect back, say, the emission of the sample, for instance, back into the fibers. And then you have, the advantage being that nowadays you have a new generation of detectors, which are especially the electron multiplying CCD, which is extremely sensitive. And what you can do is, so then you essentially during the pulse, you can sort of open the shutter many, many times, depending on this width is determined by how much tolerance you want to give to the changing field. So you decide something that you want to feel not to be changed more than 2% or whatever, and then you can decide a whole set of windows, and then you can measure, record multiple spectra. So you can do optics, you can do transport, you can also do magnetization. Magnetization, of course, or you can do susceptibility, because of course you have a changing magnetic field. So whatever you pick up is this thing.
So average.
Yes. So you say that this is, so you have to define the tolerance, and of course it depends on how strongly the sample emits also. So for each experiment, for each sample, you have to decide this window separately, and then you send the sequence of triggers to the detector. Okay. So I think I just rushed through it, but I think it's okay. So
how long can you have to wait till you go to the next pulse?
So that depends on, of course, the size. And what you do is you constantly monitor the resistance, because the resistance of the coil is a good measure of the temperature. So for our system, we've not been monitoring the resistance very carefully because it's a small resistance. So it's something like 5 minutes is okay. But larger coils, it can be hours, actually. So something like 200 kelvins, 200 to 50 kelvin. So
typical data of transport is reported. Is it acquired on one pulse, or it's average over multiple pulses?
Usually one pulse. So I don't think it's not average. So I should mention that actually, well, this is coming to this, that actually it's just with the invention of this lock-in which things have changed considerably. That lot of data which you are seeing in the past 10 years is all because of this lock-in technique. And because earlier what you would get is normally just not good enough, usually, unless you see some spectacular phenomena. So a lot of this new data is just because of this lock-in.
So lock-in operates in a time window, like few milliseconds, with a modulation of few megahertz.
So you send a reference of 1 megahertz, and that you just record. So you just have your digitizer. So one channel goes to the reference, which you feed the reference, and one channel you feed to the from the sample, and then you record a digitized signal to a duration which is a little longer than the pulse, especially after the pulse. And then of course sometimes you invert it, because initially there's this big spike and other things, so the data on the other side is smoother. So in some sense that also helps. So essentially you just record the reference and the signal, and then you do this thing. Offline. It doesn't take too long, although the files get very large. So files can be, tens of 50 megabytes or things like that. So just to say that, typically nowadays typical facilities would go to something like 70 Tesla. That's what is being offered nowadays. And there are world record fields which various facilities make, and they're of the order of most facilities are close to 90 Tesla. So what I would like to specially mention is that I was coming to this next, but it's more and more nowadays that both in Europe and in the US, that different small laboratories have closed down and people have pooled in their resources. And for instance, in Europe, there's this whole consortium of all the labs, and they try to work together, and all the small labs are practically closed down. I mean, people may still have magnets, but basically everybody comes to these to do the measurements. And so there are various kinds of things, and many, I can say this, but this is just a number. So what is interesting is, so one set of ways of generating pulse fields is with this, with these magnets, which are expected to be non-destructive. They would once in a while, of course, explode. But then there are another set of measurements that you can do, or other set of ways of generating field, is that you have these single turn coils, where you just have a single turn coil with the belief that it will explode, and before it explodes you can get to something like 300 to 400 Tesla. So the world record is something like 700 Tesla, but these fields are of the order of a few microseconds.
What would be
in what, in the magnets? So I don't know. So basically these single turn coils are most like foils actually. So they are like foils which are, so it's just a foil which is sort of wrapped together. So yeah, depends on if you are around the center, it should be okay. But some optics experiments you can do, there is no hope of doing any transport there, of course.
Is there any advantage of using superconducting coils in this?
In pulse fields?
It just goes so much above.
You just come out. Yeah. So I would just mention that. Okay. So this is just some picture of some series generators. So this is in Dresden, and this is in Toulouse, for instance. And it's a bit absurd that you put this small sample in these big these generators. And okay, couple of ideas. Again, people have been trying, and there's a lot of literature on this, that instead of having one magnet, you can have two magnets. A hybrid magnet is an example where you actually have a superconducting magnet, and inside that you put a resistive magnet. Similarly, you can have various kinds of hybrids. And for instance, you can have two pulse fields. So you have one magnet, or you can, and then on that, when that reaches the outer magnet, the field due to that reaches the highest point, then you trigger the other one. So of course, it seems nice, it does help a bit in the sense that you are distributing the stress. So this way people can, so the 100 Tesla fields which people have got in a couple of places are with all these kind of things. So there are various possibilities people have tried. I just wanted to mention that this two coil idea is also quite popular. And something which I really like is the fact that why not make it even smaller, since the sample is going to be so small. So for instance, there are some ideas here which people have been trying over the years. So for instance, this one is, as you can see, it's like around a centimeter or less in size magnet, where you can do transport measurements up to like 25-30 Tesla. So you can, in principle also, this is just 90 joules. So I don't know, you can even put it in a whole thing in helium. And this is with XRD, people have done this, again a small magnet of 2 centimeters, the whole thing is just 2 centimeters. Or you can, so these are again fields of half a millisecond or so. So it's much smaller field, of course, because the inductance is small. People have also thought about actually even micro machining, lithographically making something. So this is, I think, where we'll end. So as I said, the transport experiments have really dramatically improved after the invention of this lock-in, and now one can actually with some effort be able to do good transport measurements. And there's a lot of integration with other facilities, in Dresden they have this free electron laser which couples to this and synchrotron and XRD measurements, and small laboratories are on the way out, just with like everything else, like Amazon takes over all this thing. And there is an advantage and pleasure of doing things small. And of course, I'll be happier to sort of. So it's mostly with master students that this work has been done. And Uday and Pradeep, Dr. Uday Kumar and Dr. Pradeep Khattu have also been involved, especially in the early stages of this work. Yes, any questions, please? I'm not going to do it. So, because it's, I think it would be nice, but yeah. And I thought about it, but then it would just be like this heavy stone around my neck or legs, and you can't do anything else. So yeah, it is possible. Of course, one can, one should, and people have been talking. I think SINP, they were doing it, you only told me. And then NPL, they called me once, they wanted to do it, but I don't think so. I think in IIT Kanpur also, I think somebody was trying,
Is anybody else who's making this?
So I started this actually during my PhD, and so my advisor actually, I should acknowledge, so he sort of introduced me to this. So this is one of the, so of course he's very, very smart, And he just, everybody says that about their advisor. So anyway, so he sort of started, got me started. And so they have something, but they're also just playing around. And I think they're also not ready. So they've kept to around 10 Tesla and they're trying different things there. Yes, please, Satish sir. Yes. Yeah, I think the way you do it, I don't understand it. I should actually read up more about it. So you generate a small, basically you do it outdoors. You generate a small seed field of a couple of Tesla, and then you have a set of explosives. And this whole thing implodes. And if you do it fast enough, evidently, you can sort of, you know, it just, flux is conserved and you just gain by whatever volume. So it's, yeah, it's only for destructive magnets. And this is more for setting records, and I think they have some uses in, I think, for igniting nuclear weapons and some triggering. So I think it's I think. Actually, which one? So those 430 Tesla would be the single turn coils.
Yeah, single.
The single turn coils are typically just these coils with a capacitor bank. And yes, these are just single turn coils. So Japan people are doing it,
yeah.
And Humboldt University, this, until this person retired, they were doing that. Yeah. Yeah. 100 Tesla is also more for record, and those experiments are extremely inconvenient because the size of the magnet would be like this much. Okay, and it's just that unless you have a strong motivation, I don't think you can just use it every day. Yes, please. Yes, sir.
Because typically they store around 100 kilowatts.
Yes, yes.
There are locking amplifiers which I have in my lab.
Uh-huh.
It can go several megahertz.
Yes, so there's a 20 megahertz, even a SR, I don't know, 830, SR, whatever,
yeah.
960 or something. Or even.
Over 100 kilowatts.
So there's. Yeah.
Maybe more convenient.
No, no, no. So there are many issues here. So, firstly, so what is important is the time constant. So, because. So, time constant essentially determines many things. So one is, of course, one is that when you're using a analog lock-in amplifier, then you're limited by the kind of filters which they've put in. So the time constant would sort of determine, so if the minimum time constant, even with these megahertz lock-ins. So I don't know, there's this no time constant option, which I don't really know what it means. But basically, if you have a 30 microsecond time constant, that would mean that your stabilization time would be, for instance, something like 150 microseconds or so. So always, whenever you try to do a measurement, there will be some hysteresis due to this time constant itself. And secondly, there's this front stage itself has this preamps, and these preamps can also saturate because you have this large this thing. So it's yeah. So many in Toulouse, for instance, where they have much longer pulses, I've seen they can actually even use at 10 kilohertz. They can use SR830s. So I don't know, I mean, it's digital lock-ins is, I think, what you need to do, and it's actually not that difficult. And so you do all the, whatever the lock-in does in terms of signal processing, meaning you have low noise preamplifiers initially, and you make sure that you send in a clean signal into a digitizer, a clean amplified signal, and it's okay.
Okay, I guess no more questions. So once again, let us thank Dr.